I'm delighted now to welcome Ann Hillerman and Don Strell. Their new book is called Gardens of Santa Fe, and they are going to be at Garcia Street Books this coming Saturday at 2 in the afternoon and many other places, which we'll tell you about at the end of the show. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Pleasure
Thank
to be
you,
here.
Thank you, Charlotte.
So, as usual, the two of you make a terrific team, Ann the writer and Don the photographer coming together. The last book was the Tony Hillerman landscape book, and now this is a book of Gardens of Santa Fe, which are extraordinarily lush, beautiful, and creative. How did you come to do the book?
Well, there was a book called Secret Gardens of Santa Fe that came out in 1997, and I always loved that book. So I guess about 4 years ago, the folks from Gibbs Smith Publishing, the people who ultimately published Gardens of Santa Fe, were looking for some new projects, and they had a freelance editor who called me and said, why don't you come up with some ideas? This might be a good opportunity for you. And so Don and I talked about it because we had really been wanting to work together. And we came up with some ideas. And then when I talked to this editor, she said, well, what about doing a book on gardens? I said, well, you know that beautiful Secret Gardens book? I said, I think that was kind of the Bible of garden books. She said, oh, that was 10 years ago. Why? There certainly is space for a new garden book. So I talked to Don about it, and Don said, gardens, gee, he was used to taking sports photos. I thought, oh, this sounds kind of dull, but I twisted his arm, and so he came along.
Do you mean kind of girly?
Yeah, kind of girly. And
I wouldn't say it that way, but I drug my heels. You know, taking sports photos of soccer, basketball, skiing was certainly a different idea than taking photos of static plants, gardens, and all. And I must tell you, it was a great adventure, a great learning experience, met a lot of lovely people, and I learned a lot, technically, about photography, photographing gardens.
I think one thing you learned is that gardens aren't static.
No, constantly changing. And if you're waiting for that perfect light and the wind's blowing, you could have blurred pictures. So you've got to play all sorts of angles to get the right picture.
Now, as you write in the book, good gardeners are some combination of artist, scientist, and mover of heavy objects.
That's right. I was really surprised and delighted at how different the gardeners were who had these beautiful gardens. Well, and how different the gardens were. The gardens really sort of reflected the passion and personality of the person who had created them. But they had in common that just heartfelt love for making something beautiful. And, you know, each person's definition of what is beautiful is vastly different. But they certainly shared that just consuming passion for beautiful gardens.
So many of these are private gardens, although we will talk about some in a moment that are available for everybody to see. How did you find them?
Well, like I said, I started with gardens that were in that 1997 book because I thought, first of all, these people were already willing to have a book done about their garden. So maybe they would be interested to have another book done, you know, 20 years later, 10 years later, to see what their garden, so people could see what their gardens look like now.
Yeah, had they changed?
Yes. Yes, a lot. Some of them were pretty much the same, and some of them were vastly different. Again, depending on the personality of the gardener. And then I talked to the Santa Fe Botanical Garden people because they do public tours every June. And I thought people whose gardens were on these public tours probably had a lot of passion and also had already opened their garden gates to the public, so I didn't think they would mind. And most of them were very willing to be in the book. We ran into a few people who said, gee, this has just been a terrible year for my garden, and I'm kind of embarrassed about it. So we didn't push them. But by and large, everybody was enormously enthusiastic about the book.
Now, one of the things that one learns from reading it is that gardening in the high desert is not so easy.
Right. People talk to us a lot about water issues, weeds, soil,
caliche.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fact that when you dig down a few inches, you hit concrete.
Right.
Which is natural to our area.
Well, we talked to one gardener, and she had bought a historic home, and she and her husband actually moved here from somewhere in the south. So all of this was new to them. So they're putting in the beds for their garden, and they dig down about 6 inches and just come across concrete slabs. And as it turned out, somebody had had a garage there or an outbuilding there.
Oh, so that was real concrete.
Yeah, real concrete.
And then there's our natural, just hard surface that right. is very hard to dig through.
Right, right, right. Almost every garden I talk to, when I would always ask people for their tips, and I would say 9 people out of 10, their first tip was you need to spend a lot of time with soil preparation if you want to grow anything out here.
And how do they do that?
Compost. A lot of compost. Some of them like would buy mulch and stuff, but a lot of them made their own compost. It was so interesting. People would show us their garden, and then often they would also show us their compost heap.
Well, compost heap and worms are a recurring theme.
Right, 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 right. We talked to one guy, and I was asking, you know, what are the best tools you use to work in your garden? He said, earthworms.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, there are also creative uses of water and water conservation.
Right, right. A lot of people, I would say almost every gardener we talked to was big on mulching, making sure that there weren't just plants exposed with a lot of soil around them. Some people planted real densely, and they said that all those plants together helped retain the moisture in the soil. Some people used gravel for compost, which I thought was really, really interesting. But they said, you know, it works just fine. It doesn't blow away. One of the gardens in the book is a woman who's an expert in penstemons named Ellen Wilda. And her compost was all gravel. And she was really a fascinating, wonderful lady. She had come from, I think it was Connecticut. And she said she'd had big, lush gardens all these years. She said when she moved to Santa Fe, she was really done with that. And she wanted plants that could make it on their own. So she picked penstemons, and her compost and any material that held in the water was almost all gravel. And her plants were lovely. I mean, it was more of a sparse garden than some of the lush ones, but I really enjoyed it. And she had such a good eye for color and texture.
And it turns out that there are hundreds of species of penstemons.
Right, right, right. She had done a book on penstemons, actually, which she gave me, which is kind of like a dictionary. I don't know, I mean, thousands of them with all the Latin names. And she, I mean, again, talk about passion. She is quite the lady.
Now, there are people who are using the water from their kitchen sink and their washing machines to water their garden. And a lot of people are using runoff from the roof and from their showers to water their garden.
Right. Right. It was funny. We were out in El Dorado, and we talked to this one gardener, and he said, you might notice you see people who have rain barrels, but they're often not people who have gardens. And I thought that was interesting. And in fact, I did notice, out there, particularly in El Dorado, it seemed like there were people catching water in rain barrels, but they didn't have big gardens.
So what were they doing with it?
They were like growing vegetables. They would have little plots, but not big gardens.
Yes, and on this idea of buckets. I went into one home out in Las Campanas, and we photographed, or I photographed, and I was in the house and had to go to the bathroom. So this lady looked at me, gave me an odd-looking look, went into the bathroom. I heard some sloshing. She came by me with a bucket, went into the patio to their cistern or water-saving pond, came back with a bucket of water, handed it to me, and said, you can flush with this.
Well, I have a 5-gallon bucket in my shower, and the water.
Oh, yeah, we do too. Yeah.
So, we're talking to Don Strell and Ann Hillerman about their new book, Gardens of Santa Fe. Another theme is keeping pests away, of which there are many kinds of pests, some of them insects, some of them mammals.
Right. Right, right. One of the best stories I heard was about raccoons. These people had a wonderful compost heap, which they showed me in great detail. And they said that the problem with compost is that raccoons love it. They love to forage in there. So they had
because there's still like food remnants that taste good to them.
Yeah, banana peels and apple cores. So they had put out live traps, and they had caught 11 raccoons. And they said, I mean, they were so relieved. They thought, finally, we're done with raccoons.
What did they do with them?
They took them someplace where raccoons are needed.
Ah.
That's all they said.
That could mean I don't know what.
I don't know what either. And they didn't want to divulge their secret raccoon drop-off place.
Okay.
But anyway, they said a couple days went by, and they noticed no raccoons, so they were so happy. So the third night, they went to bed. It was a full moon, and they heard all of this clattering out on the patio. And they looked out their bedroom door, and there were five raccoons on the patio, kind of doing a little moonlight dance.
So that was that. Did they give up?
No, that's the thing about gardeners. They never give up. I don't know. I think they just decided they would have to come to terms with having raccoons in their compost.
Now, there are also rabbits and gophers and those kinds of problems, and people have different solutions for keeping them away.
Right. A lot of people, gophers were the worst problem.
Gophers are terrible.
Yeah. And some people, even the softest-hearted people we ran into, said that they had used gopher bombs. But some people, too, just sort of waited them out. If they had gophers in their yard, as much as they hated to see their plants die, they would just sort of, go out and make noise and do a lot of work in the garden, hoping to scare them away. And they said eventually they would move on.
Well, I mean, but it's crazy-making to see your long-nurtured plants be actually sucked from below and disappear into the ground. It's sort of surrealistic.
Right. Some people we talked to used sonic devices, and they said that those were supposed to keep gophers away. But they said the truth of it was that eventually gophers move on, and it's hard to know if it's just coincidence or if the sound actually does drive them away.
And then there are certain plants that people planted that rabbits don't like, and it kept them away.
Right. I think marigolds or some daffodils. And then anything that's sort of spiny or things that have a strong fragrance, rabbits don't like. And so often people would maybe do like a row of those and then plant their delicate things inside and hope that the anti-rabbit plants would keep the rabbits away. And some people just planted extra. I mean, they figured that rabbits were here, rabbits are part of nature, and so we'll just share with rabbits. And the same with fruit and birds and all of that stuff. A lot of the people we talked to had a pretty philosophical attitude about losses in their gardens to pests.
Well, it is interesting. I was watching a presentation on a fishery in a fish farm in Spain where the 20% of the fish are eaten by predators, and they determine the health of their fishery by the predators. If there's no predators, we're doing something wrong, and they take 20% loss as a sign that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing properly. And I thought, well, that's a nice way of thinking about sharing the, basically being in a cooperative relationship with our food supply and all the other predators.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, some people, the gardeners we talked to had very different attitudes about dogs.
Yes.
And there were some folks who had dogs, and the dogs scared away the raccoons and maybe scared away the gophers. But then in exchange, the dogs would dig holes in the garden and, do things dogs do. And then people who had absolutely no use for dogs in their gardens. And then people who had cats. And, and then they said, cats eat a few birds, but that's all right. We still like cats, and cats keep away mice. And it was just interesting how different people's attitudes were about all of this.
A great variety of reactions and pets, yeah.
And watering techniques, it turns out. Some people say, don't use a hose, it wastes water. The other people say, use a hose because you get to know your garden better.
Right.
So, or should we use drip irrigation, I guess? People figured out themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the majority, particularly people with big gardens, did have drip irrigation systems just because it was too much work to water each by hand. But one of the most beautiful gardens we visited out in El Dorado, that guy watered every single thing by hand. I mean, and he and his wife had a big cistern that collected all the water from the roof, and then they had pumps, and I mean, it was quite a production. But he said, I have to water by hand because I have to see how each plant is doing. And with a drip irrigation system, he wouldn't have done that.
That's another interesting thing about the book, is that people have this relationship with plants where they can, I mean, the plants kind of tell them what to do. It's like, no, we don't like it here. Let's put us over there. And somehow.
Oh, yeah. There was this one gardener. She had a purgatory. And if the plant didn't do well, she might move it. But she had a purgatory where this plant isn't going to do well anywhere, and I'm moving it to purgatory, a special area. And if it didn't do well there, well, that was the end of the plant. And otherwise, if it returned itself to a respectable flower or plant, she took it back and put it in the garden.
Put it in heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her purgatory wasn't too bad, though. I mean, even though what she called it purgatory, they still got watered and they had light and good soil.
Well, another funny thing is in the gardening tips part of the book, it says, plants are not like kids. If you don't like them, you can throw them out.
Yes.
Right. Several people told us how they had plants and they worked with them and worked with them. This one guy tried to grow azaleas. Now, most people would know it's really almost impossible to grow azaleas in Santa Fe. But he was determined, worked on it, and finally he came to the conclusion that it was impossible to grow azaleas. And he says, in retrospect, would it have been better if he had just listened to people's advice in the first place?
Well, and that's the thing. There's so many people in Santa Fe, in some of our local nurseries, who actually know a lot about plants and can give you excellent advice when you're just there at these places where you can buy them.
That's right. One gardener we talked to said that she went to the nursery, when she first came to Santa Fe, she went to the nursery every week and saw what was blooming and would buy one. You know, and she figured, you know, if it made it, it made it. But that way, the next year she would have color all year. I thought that was really smart.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so obvious. I've never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But a lot of the nurseries offer wonderful free, all kinds of free lectures, and they have free handouts on plants that are good against rabbits, plants that do well in shade if you happen to have shade, plants that do well with very little water. Yeah, they're really wonderful resources.
Now, there's quite a bit of water in the book and wonderful photographs by Don Strell. We're talking to Don Strell and Ann Hillerman about the book Gardens of Santa Fe. There are koi ponds, there are fountains, all sorts of things that at first you think maybe not very water efficient. What do you think?
I remember this one house that had five fountains. The house was something like a Red Cross symbol, and outside, that was the shape of the house. Then outside each of the cross arms was a fountain and a garden. And it was magnificent. And this lady conserved water. She used water from the roof and used gray water. And this was her garden. She's going to do it, period. And she did not waste water. She used gray water for washing clothes and for flushing toilets. And it was very well done. And it can be done that way in all gardens.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big difference of opinion about water. And, I mean, we ran into a few people who said, you know, we moved to Santa Fe X years ago before there was so much growth, and we put in our trees, and we love these trees, and if we have to pay to keep them alive, that's okay with us. I mean, we're willing to pay the premium to keep to water things that really need water. And they said, too, if they had been planting their garden now, they wouldn't have had such water-intensive plants, but they really felt a commitment to them. So, I mean, I could appreciate that point.
And there are certainly people, we haven't really talked about food, but there are people who are growing fruits and other kinds of food in their gardens.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. I was surprised at how many people we met who had beehives. This one gardener said, and they had lots of bees, and she said that when they first started bees, they noticed that a lot of the bees were dying. And so she went to a bee expert, and the expert said, well, they need water. You've got to put out, you know, water for them. So she did, and then she would notice some of them were drowned. So she arranged what she called bee beach. She put out these saucers, and she filled them full of seashells so the bees would have a place to stand while they drank.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
bee beach. Creativity of gardeners knows no end.
That's right, yes.
There are some wonderful gardens that can be seen by anybody who wants to see them. Talk about the Lenora Curtin Wetland Preserve.
Oh, I love that place. It's sort of out by the racetrack, off the frontage road. It's run by the Santa Fe Botanic Gardens. And there's a little parking area. And then you walk down a path, and there are some volunteers who greet you there and tell you, they give you a little brochure that talks about the plants you'll see and talks about the ecosystem. And then you walk down to the river where there are big cottonwood trees. It's really wonderful because you get to see desert plants, and then as you continue on the walk, you see cattails and cottonwoods and turtles and tadpoles in the river and all kinds of birds that nest around water. We saw eagles there.
I saw a huge snake swimming across the lake there, a big one too. And there were some birds, those red-chested blackbirds, I think that's what they might have been. And they were flying over this snake, squawking at it. And I suspect that the snake raided their nest.
Right, right. You realize that there are, in fact, wetlands all over the state of New Mexico, even in this dry climate, and that the conditions that make them possible are not rocket science. I mean, it's shade and trees and so on, and these things in turn attract all kinds of wildlife, and you've got suddenly these thriving little mini ecosystems.
Yeah, that's right. It was interesting. I really wanted this book to include places that just the average person could go and see. You know, often people aren't lucky enough to be here when these private gardens are on tour. So Don and I scouted around Santa Fe. Santa Fe doesn't actually have anything that would be called a public garden. Maybe the Cornell Rose Garden. But mostly what we have as public gardens are beautifully landscaped public spaces where people can see good examples of plants that really thrive here.
Now you have museums and galleries that people can walk up Canyon Road, Museum Hill, and other places where there are fantastic gardens.
Yeah. We love the landscaping up on Museum Hill. The Santa Fe Garden Club is responsible for all of that. They plant it, they maintain it. I think the museum hires somebody to actually come and, you know, take away the dead leaves and all, but the garden club is the brains behind it. And we're doing a little benefit for them as part of this book. We have a lot of pictures that didn't make it in the book, and so Don is going to show them up on Museum Hill where the garden club has where they do all their work. So that's going to be on April 10th, is it, Don? April 11th.
11th from at 5:30, the Garden Club at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture.
Yeah, and we'll list all the events at the end of the program.
Oh, another really sweet little garden that's on Museum Hill is the garden that's outside the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art. And they designed that garden to give people an idea of some of the plants that the early Spanish settlers maybe used for dye or used for wood carving or used medicinally. It's a small little space, but it's very nicely done. They also have some roses in there that are reminiscent of roses that the first Spanish settlers brought with them when they came to New Mexico.
Did you talk to people who were growing medicinal herbs?
Not many. We talked to people who were growing vegetables and growing herbs for cooking. But no. We went out to El Rancho de las Golondrinas and talked to the gardener there. And they do medicinal herbs there. But we were there toward the end of the season, and most of what they'd had already been harvested.
Now, the School for Advanced Research also has an amazing garden and grounds.
Yeah, that's really, really a beautiful space. And people can go, and they're welcome to wander around there. They have tours of the collections on Fridays that people can sign up for. And when they sign up for that, they get a garden tour as part of the package.
And, of course, let's not forget about Shedoni.
Oh, yeah. Don and I loved going out to Shedoni.
Well, at least once a year we venture out there, take a look at the new sculpture. And whereas most gardens will have plants and trees, Shedoni has sculptures growing from the ground. And it's really a gem of a place.
And some of these private gardens that you visited and that are photographed in the book Gardens of Santa Fe have sculptures of one kind or another, too, and places to sit, and they are really, really artworks.
Yeah, that's right. It was funny. We'd see all of these beautiful benches and hammocks hanging in the shade. And I would say to the gardeners, well, do you enjoy sitting there? And they'd say, oh, I never have time to sit there. Or they'd say, oh, we sit there for a few minutes, and then I notice weeds that need to be pulled, leaves that need to be plucked off, flowers that need to be deadheaded. So No, usually the time they would be sitting is also the time that they would be working. So.
Right, right. Speaking of sculptures, you also saw and photographed the garden of Ted and Barbara Flicker.
Yeah, that was really an amazing garden. They were so open-hearted. Well, everybody was to have their gardens in the book, but they took us around on a golf cart. Their garden is so big. And
Ted Flicker, the most wonderful filmmaker turned sculptor.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And his wife Barbara is one of his main models. So he showed us so many sculptures of her that were, and she had done beautiful plantings all around them. And then they had an arbor where they were growing all different kinds of grapes. From some of them, grapes again that the Spanish brought to New Mexico. And then underneath it are different sculptures of his. It was really quite a beautiful, beautiful spot.
The book is called Gardens of Santa Fe by Ann Hillerman and Don Strell. And once again, this Saturday, the 3rd of April, they will be at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe at 2 o'clock. And then on Friday, the 9th of April, they'll be at Page One Bookstore in Albuquerque. That's at 6:30 in the evening. Then the next day, Saturday, the 10th of April, they'll be at a private house at 4 o'clock. But anybody can go. All they have to do is call 505-471-9103 or go to santafebotanicalgarden.org and find out more about that. And finally, on Sunday, April 11th, they will be at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture at 5:30. That's a Santa Fe Garden Club event with a requested donation. All the other events are completely free. You can also go to Ann Hillerman, Ann with an E, Hillerman.com. Thank you so much for being here, and what a great book.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.